Sweden's application to join NATO has finally been approved, so I thought we would do a short series on Sweden and the Cold War. Now, on the surface, you might think that Sweden wasn't much of a player in that conflict, but once you look closely, you see that it was obviously not as simple as that. Although she was a neutral power throughout the Cold War, she maintained close ties with the West, and even started her own nuclear weapons program. And then of course we have her location on the Baltic Sea, which put her directly across from three Soviet states, and with the Warsaw Pact countries of East Germany and Poland to her south, as well as the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad to the southeast. So all of that meant she was involved in the Cold War, whether she liked it or not. And that's what we will focus on in today's episode. Sweden's position on the map, on the Baltic, and how that drew her into the Cold War concerning exposure to nuclear disasters, proximity to nuclear weapons tests, and incursions by Soviet subs. Before we kick off, I just want to explain my absence. There has been no podcast for a while, and I'm sorry to say that's because my dog, Bomba, Tsar Bomba, who some of you have met, he died. I've talked about it on Patreon, I've talked about it briefly in social media, so I won't go on about it in case I get upset again, but Bomba died, and that is why you won't hear any of his wee snores anymore. He used to often snore in the background, and it was so cute, I thought, that I would often leave the snores in. So he died peacefully in my arms, and I want to thank everyone for their support, in particular those people who made donations to the Dogs Trust in Bomba's name. He was the best dog in the world. Although my husband keeps reminding me of a quote that everyone thinks they have the best dog in the world, and everyone is right. So in this first episode, we are looking at Sweden's, the geography of Sweden, which puts her, or put her so close to the Soviet Union. So, famously, she was the first country, the first one outside the USSR, to detect the Chernobyl disaster. Naturally, the Soviets were keeping quiet about the explosion. We know that they were even keeping the truth from their own people. Even the residents of Pripyat were lied to, being told at their evacuation that they would be back home in a few days. So when the radiation sensors at the Swedish nuclear plant of Forsmark went off, the staff there had no idea what was happening. Forsmark is on the east coast of Sweden, so was well placed to pick up any radioactive horror being carried on the wind from the USSR. And on that terrible night, the winds were blowing northwest, taking the fallout up and across Belarus, who got the worst of it, and onwards into Lithuania and Sweden. The staff at the Forsmark plant were perplexed. The radiation sensors were going off, but nothing was wrong at the plant. Well, maybe the sensors themselves were broken. Seri Ploki's book Chernobyl, A History of a Tragedy, tells us that one staff member took a shoe to his laboratory and tested the shoe. He found that the shoe itself was horribly alive with radioactivity. So that confirmed that it was nothing to do with a faulty sensor. This stuff was in the air. It was coming from somewhere. Naturally, the Soviets denied it was anything to do with them. By now, Finland were reporting levels of gamma radiation 6 times higher than usual. The stuff was spreading around. Again and again, Sweden challenged the Soviets. And again, they denied it was anything to do with them. Eventually, Sweden's Minister for the Environment announced that whichever country was responsible for this radiation was in breach of international agreements by staying quiet. And still, the Soviets were silent. It was only after 3 days had passed that they deigned to briefly mention the disaster on their evening TV news bulletin, Vremya. Here's a clip. In Russian, obviously, but the brevity of the bulletin will show you how much detail and attention they gave it.
На Чернобыльской атомной электростанции произошла авария. Поврежден один из атомных реакторов. Принимаются меры по ликвидации последствий аварии. Пострадавшим оказывается помощь. Создана правительственная комиссия.
Of course, the Soviets had form for being silent on their nuclear disasters. In 1957, there was a terrible accident at the Mayak plant in the Urals, which didn't come to widespread attention until 1976. The plant had been built to produce plutonium for the Soviet bomb, and the excellent book Fallout by Fred Pierce tells us that the Mayak complex was built shambolically and with zero regard for the safety of its workers, their families, or indeed the landscape for hundreds of miles around. To give you just a small example of the lack of safety standards at Mayak, Pierce's book says that radioactive spills were cleaned up using a cloth and a bucket. Now, that is something straight out of Homer Simpson's nuclear plant in Springfield. So, the 1957 accident, to use the well-worn phrase, an accident waiting to happen, occurred due to the waste liquids left over from plutonium reprocessing. There was no effective nuclear waste disposal at the time. And if there had been, I'm sure you wouldn't have found it in the 1950s Soviet Union. They were not known for being at the cutting edge. So the waste liquid was simply stored in gigantic underground tanks. And these were kept cool by running water alongside them and through the gaps between the tanks. The accident happened when the cooling water stopped running and one of the tanks overheated. Quote from Fallout, the liquids in the tank had swiftly boiled, leaving behind sediment that exploded like gunpowder. It was, at the time, the world's worst nuclear accident, and it produced the world's first nuclear exclusion zone. That was in the 50s, and the rest of us didn't get any word of that until 1976. Again, the book tells us how news reached the West. It was through an article written by a Soviet scientist, one who had reached the West, of course. But this sounds very eerie. Fred Pierce also notes in his book that people in the West had got indication that something might have gone wrong behind the Urals because some villages in the area had disappeared from Soviet maps. So Sweden, because of its location, had the fortune, if you could call it that, of being the first non-Soviet country to learn that something had gone wrong, radioactively wrong, in the USSR in 1986. One of the benefits of being directly across the Baltic Sea from what was then the Soviet Union. During the Cold War, the Soviets had often referred to the Baltic as the Sea of Peace. Looking in my newspaper archives, they kept using that phrase, almost like if it happened today, you would accuse them of trying to make it go viral. They were trying to make it stick. Let's make the Baltic a Sea of Peace. But it didn't catch on. Mainly because it surely didn't seem much like a peaceful sea to the Swedes, for example, who were getting fallout sent across it. And, as we will see later, evidence of nuclear tests came rumbling across. And also, a hell of a lot of Soviet subs. Where's this peace you speak of then, eh, Soviets? Khrushchev used the phrase in July 1959 at a conference in Poland, where he argued that a whole stretch of Europe, from Scandinavia down through Central Europe and to the Balkans, should be declared nuclear-free. And by that he meant no one should be seeking to put nuclear bases or missiles there. He was aiming this message particularly at the Scandinavian countries, and this is where he used the term Sea of Peace to refer to the Baltic. He said that, quote, certain imperialist circles were wanting to put nuclear weapons in these countries, but he hoped that the Scandinavians would refuse and let the Baltic be a glorious sea of peace. Well, the Swedish were not happy about this idea. A sea of peace. Well, that is just cover for the Soviets setting rules about who may and may not be there, and what they may and may not bring with them. So the Swedish foreign minister made it clear to Khrushchev that they regard the Baltic Sea and all its inlets as waters which are free for all vessels to use in both peace and war. The Times reported that, quote, Sweden had traditionally asserted and continued to assert the freedom of the Baltic. From the point of view of international law, the inlets were to be regarded as seaways connecting free waters. So the crux of the Swedish argument was, well, the Baltic is already free. Imposing rules upon it is making it the opposite of free. And as for making it nuclear free, the minister said that the only power in the Baltic region with nukes is, yes, the Soviet Union. Now you can't argue with that logic. The people who are arguing, keep this place nuclear free, they are the ones with the nukes. Sweden isn't trying to do that, Norway isn't, Finland isn't. The only Baltic nukiness is coming from the Soviets. The Times said, quote, it is considered here that the statement by the habitually cautious foreign minister of neutral Sweden will make a strong impression in Moscow. Perhaps they didn't expect Sweden to bite back like that. And perhaps their strong position irritated Khrushchev, as he then cancelled a scheduled summer tour of the Scandinavian countries. So we know that the Soviets had caused fallout to be sent across this, as they would call it, Sea of Peace towards Sweden. There were also several occasions where Soviet submarines used the Baltic Sea to illegally enter Swedish waters. Again, how can they call it a sea of peace when they were knowingly sending submarines into the Baltic and even into Swedish waters? The most notorious of these incidents happened in October 1981, when a Soviet whiskey-class submarine ran aground off the south coast of Sweden. It ran aground on some rocks, and so the incident gained the nickname Whiskey on the Rocks. A cute nickname, but at the time, the incident caused huge tensions and fear of war. There's a good documentary about it on YouTube called Whiskey on the Rocks. It's in Swedish, but with English subtitles, and I recommend that to you if you don't know about this incident. We see in the documentary that at one point, to try and diffuse tension between the anxious, nippy Soviets who were locked in their grounded sub and refusing to come out, a Swedish officer delivered a stack of porno mags to them. Now, the incident wasn't as simple as a Soviet submarine goes a tiny bit off course and bumps into some rocks off the Swedish coast and begs pardon and asks to be released. As the documentary shows us, the submarine, an old one, a diesel-powered one, not a nuclear one, had managed to weave its way into a narrow channel peppered with rocks and entered a restricted area which Sweden used to test military equipment. And this was an area which was just a few miles away from Sweden's biggest naval base, Karlskrona, So no, you simply can't end up in such a place by accident, said the Swedes. The place is so specific, so of interest, and so peppered with rocks and narrow channels that it would have taken very careful manoeuvring to get in there. Lots of delicate twists and turns, dodging and weaving. They just obviously weren't careful enough and ended up at one point running aground. And so the submarine was stuck. A big, fat Soviet submarine stuck on rocks in full view of the Swedish coast. And of some puzzled fishermen who phoned the local police to say, the Soviets are here. So the Swedish sent men out to board the sub. But the paranoid Soviets had received orders not to let anyone board it. According to the documentary, they were also ordered to press a button and blow the boat up if the Swedes tried to storm the submarine. What makes this particularly terrifying is that the Swedish went on to secretly monitor the grounded submarine to see if it was emitting any radiation, because the Soviets wouldn't confirm or deny what we were dealing with here. Now, you can't blame the Swedish for wanting to know. This thing, which is poking out of the water just a few metres from our shores, got any nukes aboard? Anything we should be worried about? Although it has never been confirmed by the Russian authorities, the detectors did pick up the presence of uranium-238 near the torpedo tube section, implying that there were nuclear torpedoes on board. And indeed, the Swedish Prime Minister announced this to the press. They had good reason to believe that this submarine was armed with nuclear weapons. So then, if the Soviets had blown the boat up, that would surely have been the equivalent of detonating a dirty bomb off the coast of Sweden. But the Soviets later denied that the uranium readings had anything to do with the presence of nuclear weapons, with one official saying that the readings might have come from the Swedish scientists' wristwatches. Meanwhile, TASS, the Soviet news agency, dismissed the radiation readings altogether by saying they had been taken, after all, by, quote, NATO specialists. So the Soviets were hunkered down in their stranded sub, refusing to come out, and the Swedes had men lined up on the coast, guns aimed at the boat. To make things worse, a storm whipped up and the stranded submarine began jarring and grinding alarmingly against the rocks. So it sent out a distress call and, with some scary echoes of the Cuban Missile Crisis, two Soviet ships began sailing towards it, coming to its aid. Hold the border was the famous order given by the Swedish Prime Minister. Don't let these Soviet ships come storming into our waters. There they were, charging through the sea, towards a submarine, towards Sweden. Would they turn around at the last minute? Would Sweden hold the border? After 20 agonising minutes, the Navy called the Prime Minister back to say, oh, it's okay, they're just some German ships. It's not the Soviets after all. Phew. But there was still the problem of the big submarine stuck on the rocks. The Soviets stuck to their line that they were just innocently potting around in the Baltic Sea on a routine training exercise and, oops, their navigation aids must have failed. The Swedes, as mentioned, were not convinced. The area they were in was too specific, too sensitive, and needed a very twisty, delicate, careful path to get there. On the contrary, any submarine would have needed very careful navigation to find their way there. And they would have gotten away with it if it hadn't been for that pesky rock. Just on a mad hunch here, I'm going to believe the Swedish side of the story. And remember, with all of this going on, Soviets were piously saying that the Baltic should be a nuclear-free zone, a sea of peace. But they were the ones violating a neutral country's territory with what was probably a nuclear-armed submarine. So the Soviets were under orders to blow the thing up if Sweden tried to storm the submarine. And they were being very, very pernickety about who they would allow on board. And they said there could be no question of allowing a full inspection of the boat. Instead, they sent their captain up to be interrogated on a Swedish ship. Meanwhile, a limited number of Swedish naval officers were allowed inside the sub to look at its so-called faulty navigation equipment. This all formed part of a 10-day Swedish investigation, which concluded that the submarine had entered their waters intentionally to gather information on the equipment and weapons tests that they were doing in that restricted area. And of course, it was their belief that the Soviets had also, to make it all worse, brought nuclear weapons into their territory. Thankfully, the Whiskey on the Rocks incident came to a quiet and peaceful conclusion after 11 days. Having investigated as far as they could, given the bristling paranoia of the Soviets, the Swedish drew their logical conclusions, made them known to the world, then agreed to tow the boat out into neutral waters, where the commies could collect it. Well, collect it sounds quite innocent. You might collect your kids from school, or collect your parcel from the sorting office. Instead, when the Soviet Navy came to collect their boat from Sweden, they sent, quote, an armada of 11 Soviet ships, including two destroyers, two frigates, and two missile-armed corvettes, which cruised the area in a show of strength. The verdict from the Times was to label the Soviet Union the bully of the Baltic. An editorial in the paper said the Soviets had not merely violated Swedish neutrality, but the whole incident suggested their behaviour, where nuclear weapons were concerned, verged on cavalier and irresponsible. And it also makes a mockery of their, quote, holier-than-thou approach to the whole question of nuclear weapons, which is now being so openly debated in the West and so cynically exploited by the East. So their talk of the Baltic as a sea of peace and a nuclear-free zone had been shown to be ludicrous and hypocritical. The Times also suggested that the Baltic, at least the part belonging to the Nordic countries, was already a nuclear-free zone because neither Sweden, Norway, Denmark or Finland have nuclear weapons. And the two, which are members of NATO, at the time Norway and Denmark, they will not allow nuclear weapons on their soil in peacetime. Whereas across the Baltic Sea, on the Soviet side, the coastal area is teeming with nuclear installations. Quote, stretching from the north of the Kola Peninsula down to the Baltic Republics, including short and medium range missiles which could only reach the Nordic area. And it is now seen to be patrolling the Baltic with nuclear warships, intruding into the territorial waters of a neutral and unthreatening country. The editorial ended with the wise words, quote, it is what the Soviet Union does and has done, rather than what it says, which offers the best indication of the threat which faces the West. Now, the other thing the Swedish were able to detect across the so-called Sea of Peace, besides Soviet fallout and intrusion by Soviet submarines, was evidence of Soviet nuclear tests. As we know, atmospheric nuclear tests were banned in 1963 by the Partial Test Ban Treaty. This also banned underwater tests. So really, from 1963, your only option if you wanted to test a nuke was to do it underground. If you look back through the podcast archive, you'll find an episode on the Baby Tooth Survey. The episode is called, I believe, The Bone Seeker. Now, the baby tooth survey, it was an American study which asked little kids, or their parents of course, to post their baby teeth after they'd fallen out off to the laboratory. In return, they'd get a cool badge and card announcing that they were helping science. And the scientists would get thousands and thousands and thousands of tiny American teeth, which they could then test to see if radioactive material from nuclear atmospheric tests was making its way gradually and silently through the food chain and into our bodies. Children's teeth, as they are of course still growing, were the best sources for measuring that, as were children's bones, but of course it's more difficult to get access to bones. Baby teeth are much easier and less gruesome to obtain. So the results of the baby tooth survey was a horrifying yes. This stuff is becoming present in our bodies. And the results were so frightening that the survey has been credited with helping JFK realise the importance of banning atmospheric tests. So when an underground nuclear test detonates, obviously there is no visible flash or blast damage on the surface. So the best way of a foreign power being able to detect what you've been up to is by sensing and measuring the resulting earth tremor. Sweden, because of its location, was well placed to do this, just across the sea from the Soviet Union. And they had and still do have, the world-famous Seismological Institute at Uppsala University. Uppsala is on the east of Sweden, so again, looking out across the Baltic. If you look northeast from Uppsala, we see the Soviet testing ground of Novaya Zemlya. And looking southeast from Uppsala, we see their other big testing ground, Semipalatinsk in Kazakhstan. So the institute at Uppsala would be one of the first to receive, one of the first and one of the best equipped to receive the various rumbles, roars and reverberations. Now, if we're talking about Sweden's location, particularly the Baltic Sea, we must look at Sweden's largest island, Gotland, which sits almost in the middle of the Baltic Sea, putting it just a few minutes by plane from Latvia, from what was once, of course, the Soviet Union. I turn here to Timothy Phillips' book, The Curtain and the Wall, which has a chapter on Gotland and the Cold War and the strategic importance it had. He talks about the Gotland Gambit. That is, there was lots of Cold War thinking about whether the Soviets might launch an attack on Gotland. Of course, during the Cold War, Sweden was not in NATO, so the West would not be obliged to come to Sweden's aid. Of course, Sweden often worked closely with the West and with NATO in the Cold War, so the thinking was, yes, off the record, if the Soviets attacked Sweden, then yeah, surely she can count on help from NATO. But what if the Soviets didn't attack Sweden? What if they just took Gotland? Just took an island? Just one island and then pulled back? Would NATO respond? Would they risk it all for one island of a non-member country? So an invasion of Gotland, which, as mentioned, was just a few minutes by plane from the Soviet coast, might have been a good way of poking at NATO, poking and prodding and trying to destabilise it. There was also the thinking that the Soviets could seize Gotland and hold it for some kind of ransom. We'll return Gotland if you clear out of West Berlin, that type of thing. Gotland certainly had cause to feel vulnerable, being, as the author describes in his book, marooned on the edge of the West. Of course, the Soviets didn't ever invade Gotland, but there were two incidents in the Cold War which showed Gotland at the centre of nuclear tensions and how easily things could have kicked off. So I'm drawing both of these incidents from Timothy Phillips' book. Again, it's called The Curtain and the Wall. A very good read, I recommend it to you. It's a kind of mixture of travel journalism and Cold War history, where he traces the route that the Iron Curtain took down through Europe. So the first incident involving Gotland is one that you will probably be familiar with, even if you don't realise it. Even if you have never heard of the Smolny incident of 1961. I had never heard of Smolny till I read this book. But as I was reading it, I was thinking, hey, hang on, this story sounds familiar. So a Soviet Navy ship, the Smolny, sailed into a Gotland harbour in April 1961. It was the middle of the night when it arrived. Is this how the invasion might start? But there was no invasion. Instead, the captain, accompanied by an officer, rowed ashore on a lifeboat. The ship was in distress, he said, and the captain had bravely guided it towards safety in the Swedish harbour. Of course, they were met by a ton of armed officers, at which point the captain, to the horror of his fellow Soviet officer, announced that he wanted to defect. It turns out the ship wasn't in distress. The captain just wanted out of the Soviet Union. So why not just sail to freedom? Just turn the boat around, telling a few porkies to your crew along the way. And yes, you might recognise that story because it is the basis of the plot of The Hunt for Red October. Phillips tells us in his book that the rest of the crew of the Smolny seemed stricken with panic or indecision without their captain, as they didn't seem capable of sailing away back to the USSR. Maybe they were afraid to, having to bring such bad news back to the commies. So Sweden towed the Smolny into their port, but not before ramming the place full of soldiers and ships and with military aircraft flying overhead. They wanted to be very careful lest the Smolny turn out to be a, quote, sort of maritime Trojan horse. So they brought the ship in, carefully guarded, and then Soviet diplomats were summoned from Stockholm to talk to the crew and find out what the hell was going on. The next day, Sweden kindly guided the Smolny back out to sea and it went off home. Minus one of their crew, of course, their captain, who went on to live in America and Guatemala, and who may or may not have looked like a bearded John Connery. The other incident Timothy Phillips mentions is the Catalina affair. This one is far more sombre than the colourful Smolny story. In June 1952, the Soviets shot down two Swedish planes over the Baltic Sea. The first plane to be shot down was a Swedish Air Force plane. All eight members of the crew died. 3 days later, a Catalina flying boat flew over the area to search for the wreckage. The Soviets shot that down too. However, her crew survived and were rescued by a German ship. For 40 years, Sweden insisted that the first plane was doing nothing other than a navigation training flight. But, decades later, were forced to admit that it had been conducting surveillance on behalf of NATO. Timothy Phillips says in his book, the Swedish government hid that fact for 40 years, but it is likely what provoked the USSR to attack. He goes on to say the USSR denied involvement in both incidents right up until 1991 and refused to make any other comment. This left the widows and families of the dead wondering whether their loved ones had perished at sea or been picked up and spirited into Soviet captivity. For people on Gotland, the episode was a powerful reminder of their position right up against the maritime Iron Curtain. Now, there's plenty more to be said about Sweden. That's why I'm going to turn this into a short series. So in the next episode, we're going to look at Sweden's vast network of shelters and also its siren network and its civil defence booklets. There's plenty to talk about with Sweden. And let me thank my new patrons who've joined recently and for all the kind comments that people left on my Patreon page when I announced that Bomba had died. That really did comfort me, so thank you. My newest patrons are Sally H, Tom Diggins, Leon and Paul. Oh, and Anne Tierney. Sorry, Anne. So thank you everyone for listening, and I'll be back next week with part 2 of our episode on Sweden.